Chapter 3.
What's the difference between a lightsaber and a glow rod?
A lightsaber impresses girls.
Jason Solo, age 14. Shortly before he cut off Tenel Ka's arm in sparring practice. He had made a few mistakes. Titus could see that now. He had fallen to the same temptation all Sith did. Had cut himself off from everything he loved. His family, his lover, even his daughter. To avoid being distracted by their betrayals. He could see now how blinding himself to his pain had also blinded him to his duty. How he had begun to think only of himself, of his plans, of his destiny, of his galaxy. Self-absorption. That was the downfall of the Sith, always. He had studied the lives of the ancients. Such greats as Nega Sado, Freedon Nadd, Exar Kun. And he knew that they always made the same mistake. That sooner or later they always forgot that they existed to serve the galaxy. And came to believe that the galaxy existed to serve them. And Kytus had stepped into the same trap. He had forgotten why he was doing all this. The reason that he had picked up a lightsaber in the first place, and the reason that he had given himself over to the Sith, the reason that he had taken sole control of the Galactic Alliance. To serve. Kytus had forgotten because he was weak. After Alana had betrayed him by sneaking off the Anakin Solo with his parents, his pain had become a distraction. He had been unable to think, to plan, to command, to read the future, to lead. So he had shut away his feelings for Alana, had convinced himself that he was not really doing this for her and the trillions of younglings like her, that he was doing this for destiny, for his destiny. It had all been a lie. Even after what Alana had done, Kytus still loved her. He was her father, and he would always love her, no matter how much she hurt him. He had been wrong to try to escape that. Kytus needed to hold on to that love, whatever it cost him, to cling to that love, even as it tore his heart apart. Because that was how Sith stayed strong. They needed pain to keep the balance, to remind them they were still human. And they needed it so they would not forget the pain they were inflicting on others. To make the galaxy safer, everyone had to suffer, even Sith lords. And so there would be no angry outbursts when he confronted the Moffs over their unauthorized adventures. No demonstration killings, no force chokings or threats to have his fleets attack theirs, no intimidation of any sort. There would be no consequences at all. For how were they to know of the worrisome things he had been seeing in his force visions lately? The Mandalorian maniacs and the burning asteroids, his uncle's inescapable gaze, if he failed to tell them. Whether blunder or masterstroke, the taking of the Roach system was as much his doing as the Moff's, Kytus saw now, and he was beyond punishing others for his mistakes. Starting today, Darth Kytus was going to rule not through anger or fear or even bribery, but as every true Sith Lord should, through patience and love and pain. Kytus finally crested the winding ped ramp he had been ascending and found himself looking down a long tubular tunnel coated in the gray-yellow foamcrete the Verpine reserved for their royal warrens. At the far end, guarding one of the shiny new Beskar alloy blast hatches that had done absolutely nothing to stop the remnant's aerosol attack, stood a squad of white-armored stormtroopers. Their gray-striped shoulder plates identified them as members of the Imperial Elite Guard, and the two tripod-mounted E-webs set along the walls suggested they were serious about preventing unauthorized access to the chamber beyond. The stormtroopers were still turning in his direction, no doubt trying to decide whether the single black-clad figure striding toward them was anything to be alarmed about, when Kytus raised a gloved hand and made a grasping motion. The squad leader raised his own hand as though returning the greeting, then was knocked off his feet as both E-Web supply cables tore free of the power generators and came flying down the corridor with weapon and tripod bouncing along behind them. The remainder of the squad swiftly moved to firing positions, dropping to a knee in the middle of the corridor or pressing themselves against the tunnel wall, and brought their blaster rifles to their shoulders. Kytus sent a surge of force energy sizzling down the corridor, reducing the electronic opticals inside their helmets to a blizzard of static. They opened fire anyway, but most of the bolts went wide, and those that did not, Kytus deflected with the occasional flick of a hand. He was still 10 paces away when the squad leader pulled his helmet off and, bringing his weapon to bear, began yelling for the others to do the same. Kytus raised his arm, catching the leader's bolts on his palm and deflecting them harmlessly down the tunnel. As the second and third man prepared to open fire, he flicked a finger toward the leader's blaster and sent it spinning into them. It slammed the second man into the wall and knocked the third's weapon from his hands. Kytus summoned the leader forward with 2 fingers, using the force to bring the astonished soldier flying into his grasp.
"I have no intention of harming anyone beyond that door,"
Kytus said, making his voice deep and commanding.
"But I have no time to waste, so I won't hesitate to kill you or your men. I trust that won't be necessary."
The sergeant's eyes bulged as though his throat were actually being squeezed shut, which it was not, and his face paled to the color of his armor.
No, sir, not at all.
The sergeant motioned for his men to lower their weapons.
Sorry.
"No apologies necessary, Sergeant,"
Kytus said.
"Obviously, you haven't been informed of the new chain of command."
Kytus set the sergeant's boots back on the tunnel floor, then turned to look at each of the others in the squad. He made it appear that he was requiring each man to look into his yellow eyes, but actually he was force-probing their emotions, looking for any hint of anger or resentment that suggested there might be a hero in the group. He was down to the last 2 when he sensed a fist of resolve tightening inside one.
"Don't do it, trooper,"
he said.
"There aren't enough good soldiers in the Alliance as it is."
The fist of resolve immediately began to loosen, but the trooper wasn't too surprised to say,
"With all due respect, Colonel, we're not Alliance soldiers."
"Not yet."
Kytus gave him a warm smile and turned toward the blast hatch, presenting his back to the entire squad.
"My escorts will be along shortly. Don't start a firefight with them."
When he felt the squad leader motion the hero and everyone else to lower their weapons, Kytus nodded his approval without turning around. Then he circled his hand in front of the blast door, using the force to send a surge of energy through its internal circuitry until a series of sharp clicks announced that the locking mechanisms had retracted. A moment later, a loud hiss sounded from inside the heavy hatch, and it slid aside into the wall. Kytus stepped through without hesitation and found himself looking down on a sunken conference pit where a couple dozen Imperial moths, most of the survivors of the slaughter aboard the Bloodfin, were rising to their feet, some reaching for their sidearms and others looking for a place to take cover. Across from them, A small swarm of insectoid administrators from other verpine hives squatted on their haunches, their shiny heads cocked in confusion, and their mandibles spread wide in an instinctive threat display.
No, please.
Kytus extended his arms toward the moths and motioned for them to return to their seats, using the force to compel obedience.
Don't get up on my account.
The moths dropped almost as one. Most landed in the chairs they had been occupying, but a couple missed and landed on the floor. Several of the aides standing behind the moths' chairs were pointing holdout blasters in his direction, looking to their superiors for some hint as to whether they should open fire or stand down. Kytus swept his arm up and sent them all flying out of the conference pit onto the surrounding service floor.
I'm afraid this will be a confidential conversation,
he said.
Leave us.
When the aides did not instantly obey, he gestured at one of those who had been pointing a blaster at him and sent the man tumbling out the hatch.
Now.
The remainder of the aides scrambled for the door, many without bothering to stand. Kytus watched them go, his attention divided between them and the moths, ready to pin motionless anyone who even thought about raising a weapon. Once the aides were gone, a simple glance was all it took to send the verpine administrators scuttling after them, leaving him and the moths alone with a single huge verpine with age-silvered eye bulbs and a translucent patch on her thorax where the carahide was growing thin. She showed no inclination to rise from her position at the far end of the conference table, where she lay stretched along a heavily cushioned throne pedestal.
Jason Solo, where will the hives ever gather the wealth to settle our account?
The verpine spoke in an ancient, thrumming voice that seemed to resonate from the very bottom of her long abdomen. As the High Coordinator of the Roach System's capital asteroid, she was effectively the Hive Mother and Chief Executive Officer of her entire civilization, outranking even the Verpine's public face, Speaker Sas Sikili.
First you rescue us from the Ancient Ones, and now you come with your fleet to send away the White Shells. Welcome.
Thank you, your maternalence, but the name is now Kytus, Darth Kytus.
The Hive Mother inclined her head.
We have heard you went through a metamorphosis. It is hard to believe you were just a larva when you saved us before.
She unfolded an age-curved arm and gestured at the moths.
The hives will be happily rid of these wasps. Proceed.
I wish it were that simple,
Kytus said. He turned his attention to the moths, who were studying him with expressions ranging from impatience to annoyance, depending on whether they were brave, astute, or just plain foolhardy.
But you're misinterpreting our presence. My fleet and I aren't here to free the Roach System. We're here to hold it.
It was difficult to tell who was more outraged, the mandible-clacking Hive Mother or the grumbling moths. Kytus raised his hand and, when that failed to produce quiet, used the force to muffle the clamor. As soon as he could be sure of making himself heard again, he said,
This will be best for everyone. The conquest of the Roach System has given it a significance far beyond the value of its munitions factories.
The Hive Mother raised her thorax off her couch and demanded,
What significance? The hives are neutral. We have nothing to do with your war.
You have been selling munitions to all sides, and profiting handsomely, interrupted a combat-trim moff with close-cropped gray hair. That makes you a legitimate target.
Moff Lesserson makes a good point,
Kaida said.
And I did warn you that the Mandalorians lacked the strength to protect you.
Before the Hive Mother could argue, he turned to Lesserson.
But the Moff Council should have consulted with me before acting. There have been indications in the Force all along that this invasion would be a mistake.
Because you want the Roach munitions factories for yourself? Scoffed a youthful Moff.
Kytus recognized him from intelligence hollows as Voriam Bao. With his honey-colored complexion, curly black hair, and a sneering upper lip just begging to be ripped off his face, he looked even younger than the 23 standard years listed in his file.
"Spare us your dark prophecies, Colonel Solo," Bao continued boldly. "Everyone at this table sees what you're trying to do."
The bile began to rise in Kytus's throat, but he reminded himself of his resolution and resisted the urge to snap the young Moff's neck, as he had Lieutenant Tebbutz not so long ago. Instead, he said in a calm, durasteel voice,
"You really should listen more carefully, Moff Bao."
He made a dipping motion with his index finger, and Bao's head sank toward the table as though he were bowing.
"It's Kytus now. Darth Kytus."
If Bao's older peers were amused, they did not show it, not even in the Force. They simply glared at Kytus. And another of the Moffs, this one a round-faced man with a roll of red neck flab hanging over the collar of his buttoned tunic, shook his head in open disapproval.
"We are all aware that you are very powerful in the Force, Darth Kytus," he said. "But you seem to be forgetting that we are quite powerful in our own right. If not for us, that catastrophe at Fondor would have been the end of you and the Galactic Alliance. Nor do we need to consult with you about anything," Moff Lesserson added. "The last I checked, the Empire was an ally of the Galactic Alliance, not its territory. We don't need your permission to conduct our operations, and we surely don't need your fleets to hold what we take."
Kytus brought his anger under control by reminding himself that he deserved such a rebuke. He had not failed at Fondor because of Neothel's treachery, or his admiral's lack of boldness, or even because of Dala's surprise attack. He had failed because of his own blindness, because he had allowed his anguish over Alana's betrayal to make him arrogant and selfish and vindictive. And then, once his thinking had cleared, he began to see how the situation must look to someone who did not have the Force, to someone who could not look into the future and see Luke hunting him down, or see Mandalorian maniacs bursting from walls and asteroids burning as bright as stars. Kytus's assertion might be hard to believe. Without such foresight, it might be easy to convince oneself that this lonely cluster of rocks could not be as important as all that, that the balance of an interstellar war could never hinge on what was about to happen here. After a moment's silence, Kytus said,
"You don't believe me."
His tone was more disappointed than angry.
"You think this is about spoils?"
Lesserson exchanged suspicious glances with several of the other Moffs, then asked,
"You don't really expect us to believe you came out here to protect us, do you?"
Kytus had to stifle a laugh. While he hadn't been thinking of it in those terms, he realized that was exactly what he was doing here, protecting the Moffs and their crucial fleets.
"I suppose that does sound absurd,"
Realizing that only events themselves would convince the Moffs of his sincerity, Kytus turned and started toward the exit.
The truth so often does.
Ben had heard officials from the Reconstruction Authority speak of Monument Plaza as their crowning achievement, a fitting finale to the agency's commission as the rebuilder of galactic civilization. Their technicians had spent 3 years sonichipping a 2-meter crust of Yuuzhan Vong Yorick coral off the classic Old Republic architecture that surrounded the square, and their artisans had dedicated 5 years to replicating, with original methods and materials, the thousands of ancient statues that had given the plaza its name. Even Knobhead, the outcropping of bare mountaintop that was one of the only places on Coruscant where one could touch actual planetary surface, had been rescued. A team of RA geologists had spent more than a year scrubbing away a blanket of stone-dissolving lichen that may or may not have been a Yuuzhan Vong terraforming device. By the RA's own very loud proclamation, the project was a stellar success, one more example of the job it had done restoring the galaxy to its pre-Yuuzhan Vong glory. What Ben saw, however, was a vast durasteel square teeming with bored tourists and loitering office workers, strewn with litter and badly in need of a cleansing rain. The smog-pearled sky was kept blissfully free of air traffic by a no-fly security zone, and the only possible location for an observation post was inside the monuments themselves, all of which were surrounded by softly rumbling rivers of sightseers that would render even the most sophisticated eavesdropping equipment useless. In short, what Ben saw was the perfect place to avoid being seen without being obvious about it, a seething mass of life so vast that even GAG could not identify every being it contained. No wonder Lan Shevu liked to meet his informants here. Ben found one of Shevu's favorite statues, a gray monolith depicting a droid mechanic, and sat on one end of the empty viewing bench. A hologram of an attractive female Sulliston rose out of the plaza decking and began to explain that devoted technician was both the newest and largest monument in the plaza, a fitting tribute to the billions of dedicated beings who had worked so hard under the Reconstruction Authority to rebuild the galaxy after the war against the Yuuzhan Vong. The hologram continued, spewing a self-congratulatory stream of propaganda about the remarkable job the RA had done with limited resources in a very difficult political climate. If Ben had not had more important things to think about, like why the hairs on his neck were standing erect when he knew he hadn't been followed from the Mizoban spaceport, he would have been bored to yawns. Ben had experienced that same sensation 1,000 times since he had left the Sweet Time, the much-modified KDY space yacht the strike team was using as its base of operations. He reached out in the Force, searching for anyone who might be watching him. Lan Shevu might be a GAG captain himself, but anyone who caught him talking to Ben would instantly realize that Shevu was also a spy, a traitor who wanted to bring Kytus down as much as Ben did. Well, almost as much. Kytus hadn't murdered Shevu's mother, after all. Ben was being watched, of course. Aunt Leia and his cousin Jaina were both in the crowd, serving as his backups, but keeping their distance to avoid drawing attention to him or Shevu. And he could sense about 12 young females keeping a furtive eye on him, overly interested, but bearing no hint of harmful intentions, probably just admiring the Arcanian wardrobe that Aunt Leia had chosen as part of his nobleman's disguise. There were also several presences that felt watchful but not focused, no doubt just plainclothes security agents looking for nervous demeanor, irrational conduct, or any of 1,000 other behaviors that usually betrayed terrorist attacks in the making. What Ben did not sense was any curiosity or suspicion directed his way. no hint that he would be bringing danger along when he made contact with Shevu. Reassured, he rose and made his way to the opposite corner of the monument. Shevu was standing behind a viewing bench, posing as a tourist. He wore the now meaningless uniform of the Reconstruction Authority Space Patrol, and he was using a small vid cam to record another hologram, this one narrated by an attractive Faline female. His hair was tinted gray, and he was wearing a false goatee beard in the same color. In fact, he looked so much like a retired RASP pilot that despite his familiar force presence, Ben wasn't quite sure he had the right man. Or maybe it was the changes that weren't part of Shevu's disguise that were throwing Ben off. The sunken eyes and ashen complexion, and the worry lines that seemed to have appeared from nowhere. Ben stopped half a step in front of him and a little off to the side, pretending to be interested in the same hologram. It was a bit more interesting than the last one. The Faline was explaining how the Reconstruction Authority had liberated the Maltorian mining belt from the notorious pirate captain Three-Eye. Shevu surprised him by speaking first.
"That's not quite how it really happened, you know," he said. "I could tell you about Three-Eye, if you're interested."
Ben casually turned and found Shevu smiling at him from behind his vidcam, but also holding his brow cocked in concern and curiosity.
"So you were there, sir?"
Ben asked, still playing the role of the polite young noble. Shevu shook his head.
"I'm acquainted with some people who were. The way I heard it, the fighting was over by the time we arrived. Three-Eye was actually handed over to us by a pair of Jedi Knights."
He lowered his vidcam and looked directly at Ben.
"Jedi have a funny way of doing that. Just appearing when nobody expects them."
"I'm sure they have their reasons," Ben said. "Did you serve with RASP long, sir?"
"The whole 10 years, Shevu said. "Time of my life."
When Shevu did not suggest a snack or lunch as a prelude to going somewhere they could talk more freely, Ben realized his friend was also worried about their security. He extended his force awareness again, and this time he did feel a pair of focused presences, but they were focused on Shevu, not him. The Watchers could have been a GAG backup team, of course, but Ben doubted it. Shevu came here to meet informants, and a careful spymaster did not risk his assets by allowing a backup team to see them. If someone had Shevu under surveillance, it was because they suspected him of treason. Ben's first instinct was to take his friend and flee, but that would be a stupid move. Even if they could fight their way out of the plaza, Shevu's defection would be considered a security emergency. By the time they reached the sweet time at Mizoban, GAG would have a full-scale recovery effort underway, with every spaceport on the planet sealed tight and whole divisions of GAG troopers scouring every cranny within 100 kilometers of the plaza. Ben finally identified Shevu's watchers, a narrow-snouted Rhodian couple about 30 meters away. They were pressing suction-tipped fingers to each other's green cheeks, running a vidcam, and generally trying too hard to look like a couple on holiday. Ben began to subtly flick his fingers in their direction, sending a steady stream of surveillance-negating force flashes toward the vidcam. Once Ben felt certain that the Rhodian's recording equipment was useless, he turned back to Shevu.
"Do you know what happened to him? Three-Eye, I mean?" Ben asked, continuing to speak obliquely, but coming directly to the point.
If he and Shevu were at risk, it was best to get done and get gone.
"I have some friends who might like to meet him. I'm sure you would find it worthwhile to help us."
Shevu's brow shot up.
"How worthwhile?"
"We could make you a very happy man in a very short time," Ben replied. "As a matter of fact, we're making preparations for a meeting with him now."
The look that came to Shevu's face was equal parts surprise and fear.
for an instant, Ben thought that he had been misreading his friend all along, that either Shevu did not want to be involved in moving against Kaidus so directly, or he had been Kaidus's double agent from the beginning. Then Shevu smiled.
"There's no telling how long it would take to put you in touch face to face," he said. "But I can tell you where to find him. Would that be worth something to you?"
Ben nodded. "Probably. How much depends on how hard it would be for us to arrange a meeting."
"Should be easier than on Coruscant," Shevu replied. "I hear that Three Eyes' new gang has been causing problems on Nickel One. The last I heard, he was on his way to bring them into line."
"Are you sure?" Ben asked. Two different intelligence services, Hapen and Wookie, had confirmed that the Anakin Solo was in its hangar at Crick Space above Coruscant. "We've heard that his space yacht is still in its moorings."
"Security precaution," Shevu replied. "He crossed some boffins a while back, and it's become advisable for him to travel in something a little less conspicuous. He's definitely gone to Nickel One."
"Nickel One?" Ben repeated.
Suddenly, the remnant's easy conquest of the Roach system seemed more convenient than alarming. Asteroids were small places, and if the Jedi acted quickly, they would be able to slip a strike team into place before the Imperials had a chance to debug their security operation. He reached for a credit chip.
"That should be worth something to us. How about..."
Ben let the sentence trail off as he felt Jaina reaching out to him in the Force, warning that trouble was on the way. He looked past Shevu and saw the Rodian couple coming, their hands slipping into the pockets of their outer tunics.
10,000? Shevu asked, misinterpreting Ben's sudden silence and still trying to maintain cover. "It's not easy to come by that kind of information, and if Three Eye ever finds out..."
"Sekker!" Ben yelled, using the galaxy-wide slang for a public security officer.
He hit Shevu in both shoulders, but harder in the right, so that he would be spun around and see the approaching Rodians.
"Dead, Sekker!"
Hoping to make it appear that he was resisting arrest, and that Shevu was therefore not involved in anything disloyal to Kaidus or GAG, Ben drew his holdout blaster and fired past his friend's head. The first bolt came close enough to raise a heat welt along Shevu's jaw and make it appear the effort to kill had been sincere. The other three shots were not so close, scattering the crowd and sending the two Rodians diving for safety.
"Sorry,"
Ben hissed, leaning close to Shevu's head.
"I think they were watching you. Maybe you should come..."
Shevu elbowed him in the ribs, lifting him off his feet and drawing a real grunt of pain.
"No, you go!"
Shevu spun around, simultaneously reaching for his blaster and clutching at Ben's cloak lapel.
"Make it look arg!"
The order ended in a surprised scream as Ben clamped a hand over Shevu's wrist and pivoted away, sending his friend into a flying somersault that ended with him lying flat on his back.
"See ya,"
Ben whispered.
"Good luck."
He put a couple of blaster bolts through the loose cloth of Shevu's tunic for good measure, then turned to run. He found himself staring down a 100-meter aisle that seemed to be spontaneously opening in front of a woman sprinting through the crowd toward him. Dressed in a dark cloak and black GAG armor, she had blonde hair, a lightsaber hilt in her hand, and a dozen GAG commandos following close on her heels.
"Oh, criff,"
Ben said.
"That's Tahiri."
The rising whine of repulsor lift cooling fans began to howl over the plaza, and Ben looked up to see a flight of GAG black troop sleds sweeping down from the milky sky.
"Go," Shevu ordered. "Make this count."
Ben obeyed instantly, charging into a mass of beings slowly pressing away from the Reconstruction Authority monument in an effort to escape the fight about to erupt in their midst. Assuming Shevu would be close behind him, he began to use the Force to clear a path ahead,
at the same time tearing away the wig and heavy robes of his Arcanian disguise. Ben was traveling in the opposite direction from Jaina and Aunt Leia, trying to protect the mission by moving the action away from his backup team. When the odds got this bad, it was better to split up and avoid getting your partners captured or killed as well. That way, at least there would be someone left to file the report. The crowd broke into screams as energy bolts began to zing back and forth across the square behind him. And that's when Ben realized Shevu wasn't with him. He stopped and spun around, but all he could see was the constant flash of blaster fire flickering through the wall of panicked tourists backing toward him. Ben tore the finger socks, part of his disguise, from his hands and started to push back toward the fight. Then remembered the last thing Shevu had said to him before sending him off. Make this count. If Ben rushed back there now, he would be doing just the opposite, robbing Shevu's sacrifice of meaning, and in all likelihood still failing to save him. Leaving his lightsaber to hang on the belt beneath his tunic, Ben pulled the comlink from his pocket. He allowed the press of the crowd to push him slowly backward, away from what now sounded more like a tap-calf fight than a shootout, determined to make this count, and then go back for his friend. He did not open a direct channel to the sweet time. That would give GAG eavesdropping droids the few precious seconds they needed to trace his signal and identify the rest of his team. Instead, he recorded a quick message describing what he had learned about Kytus's location, ending with a report of Shevu's capture, and most likely his own. He formatted it for a 5-millisecond burst transmission that would be too fast to track, then opened the channel to the sweet time, and felt a cold prickle of danger sense race down his spine. A familiar female voice sounded a pace behind him.
Don't transmit it, Ben. I won't hesitate to kill you.
You just did. Ben depressed the transmit button, then tossed the comlink into the air and reached for his lightsaber, only to find Tahiri's hand already there.
Bad idea, she said.
Ben spun toward the hand, bringing an arm up and smashing his elbow into the side of her head. He started to tell her that she talked too much, then heard the snap hiss of an igniting lightsaber and realized he had just made the same mistake. A line of scalding pain erupted across his lower back, and he saw the bright glow of Tahiri's blade tip shining beside and a little behind him. When his body did not fall to the plaza deck in two pieces, he guessed that he was still alive and continued his spin, bringing his hand around in a reverse knife-hand strike that would have caught her just below the ear and almost certainly knocked her unconscious. Had she not blocked? As Ben's head snapped back, he caught a glimpse of scarred brow and blonde hair, then felt his teeth biting through his tongue and his feet flying out from beneath him, and realized Tahiri had caught him beneath the chin with a fist or an elbow or a hydraulic hammer, and it hardly mattered which, because all he could feel was the inescapable darkness of a black hole drawing him down into the singularity of unconsciousness, into helplessness, defeat, and death. Ben refused to go. He lashed out in the Force, grabbing at the last place he had seen Tahiri, pulling with all his might and feeling something give. Feeling something like legs or ankles or feet come flying toward him, then hearing Tahiri scream in anger or pain, or maybe just surprise. A sharp clang echoed through the plaza decking as her armor hit, and the darkness started to retreat from Ben's head. He sensed Tahiri lying at his feet, just as flat on the deck as he was. She swore, profaning Ben's dead mother and promising to make him pay for making this so hard. Then he saw his lightsaber lying on the durasteel not far from his hand, surrounded by a dozen pairs of black boots, but still within his Force grasp. Ben reached out in the Force, Half a dozen troopers cried out in astonishment as the weapon banged off their boots, spinning and tumbling through the thicket of shins and ankles to arrive in his hand upside down, with the emitter nozzle pointed straight into his eye. Tahiri's voice sounded from a meter beyond his feet.
"I've had it with this creedle!"
Ben flipped the lightsaber around and sat up. Tahiri was sitting up now, too, looking straight toward him. Her face was slimmer and more lined than he remembered it, but still as beautiful as ever, framed by a halo of flowing golden hair and marred only by the three diagonal scars on her brow and the fury in her eyes.
"Put him out," Tahiri ordered. "Now!"
Ben ignited his lightsaber. And that was when he saw, finally, the black wall of GAG troopers arrayed around him in a ring, all pointing blaster rifles in his direction. He gave himself over to the Force, and felt himself springing to his feet, his blade moving to block, then heard it bat 1, 2, 3 blaster bolts aside before a flurry of hot punches caught him square in the back. His body exploded into paralyzing pain, and the electric darkness rose up to swallow him again.